I don't know. Alright, well, anyway, the music on Drive-Thru is giving fits this afternoon. It's Monday, August 10th. This is Mike Vandervoort starting another week in hot August. We have our guest today coming to us from across the pond, Bill Borman. Welcome to Drive-Thru HR. How are you doing today?
Yeah, it's good. It's great to be back, Mike. Great to be back and good to be talking to you as the host.
Thanks. Yeah, it's different. And it's the first time. So, Bill, we did a quick pre-show, and you said you were the first guest ever on.
Yeah, I was the first guest in Brian Wempen's day, and I also did a show with Tin Cup when he was fairly new.
So okay,
it's good
well,
to be talking to you and seeing what you guys have done.
Likewise, well, you're kind of that kind of makes you the spirit guide of the new hosts, then I guess. No, I haven't seen Brian in a couple of months, but Brian seems to be doing well. And so where are you in the world today, Bill? You are one of the biggest travelers I know. So are you at home or are you elsewhere?
I'm actually home. I'm going to be in Dublin later this week, working with the guys from Clinch.io, and then I'm taking vacation, and then it's True London.
Nice. Well, so for those few people in the world that may not actually know who Bill Borman is, give us your bio and tell people what you do, Bill.
Okay, so I'm still figuring out what I do, really, to be honest, Mike. But I am. My headline is I'm the Managing Director for Innovation and Technology for Recruiting Daily LLC, which means I deal with the advisory technology and event side of Recruiting Daily, recruiting blogs, recruiting tools, plus advisory to startups. I work with about 7 startups in the recruiting space on building product roadmap. I then do 2 deployments a year with global organizations on both method and technology they need to buy. So people like NASPERS and Oracle, BBC, it tends to be global brands that I work with, and I do that twice a year. And I run about 65 to 100 events a year under the Recruiting Unconference, which is really kind of the research and understanding the market and community piece.
Yeah,
plus I write a bit of stuff and do all kinds of things.
So, and you've had a very interesting, again on the pre-show, you had probably one of the earlier versions of this type of show. You've always been an innovator, but you want to kind of tell us how you got, because you made a really I think one of the more broad swings. You were at one point in your career very traditional suit guy in London,
yeah,
and now you're non-traditional. You know, and our new theme, as you know, Bill, is to talk about failure. But let's just talk about you real quickly. I mean, how did you make the transition? And you know, give us a little bit of that backstory, because I find
it fascinating. My background is I started out in recruiting at 16 as a third-party recruiter in an agency. I proceeded on that path for quite a few years. I ended up being a board director of a recruitment business that we grew from 6 offices to 175. And I became all kinds of things. So I started out training. I always describe it as I was a guy who did HR rather than an HR guy. We ended up in a couple of tribunals one day, decided that we needed to have some kind of structure and legal basis to what we were doing, and my boss said, okay, that's your job now. And I said, well, how do I learn that? And he said, well, how am I going to learn that? He said, well, go to the library. And that was how we started, pre-internet day. So I learned a lot of things. We built a good business over 12 and a half years. I then went and started my own training company, which I ran for 6 years, which grew to quite a big business, traditional training. And we had 5 fantastic years of growth, 1 year of terrible time, which was when the recession came along. None of my clients could pay me. I went into bankruptcy with both the business and personally, and for the first time kind of had to start again. My office is in my house, and I had two options. I either did what my wife was managing me to do, which was kind of the gardening and put some shelves up. Also, not being in corporate life, it was the first time the phone hadn't rung and I didn't have somewhere to go, kind of that day. Or pretend to be busy. And the best way to pretend to be busy was to get on social media. And that's what I did. And I think there was a few important things which I could subsequently learn from that. One is I didn't have a business at that point, so I didn't have an objective. Twitter was brand new, and I literally spent 16 hours a day connecting and talking to people and just finding new people. You know, like I think we connected around about that time, Mike.
Yeah,
I was doing 150 tweets a day, and I started a LinkedIn group and subsequently started a blog talk radio and took a different approach to connecting and understanding networking, really. And that's given me some real kind of basis that's formed this whole alternative career. When you go through something like that, if you go through a period of bankruptcy, and I had kind of three houses, one of them in Florida, I had brand new cars every year, you actually discover that all of that is stuff which you don't really need. And the things that are important are doing things that you want to do, that you feel is doing things that are right and for good, and you also get this sense of you don't need that stuff anymore. What you need to do is just look at how can you connect and learn, and the network that you make dictates through need what you become. And that was also at a time when I just said, you know what, I'm going to get rid of the suits and all that kind of stuff. And now, obviously, I've grown beards and all the rest of it.
Yeah, now you have a hat collection and regular previews.
I became the guy in a hat completely. There's nothing in my career path, I'd say, in the last 7 years, which has been deliberate or planned. So there's been nothing strategic. Everything has been understanding the networking. I think 90% of the work that we do in the modern age is unpaid, but should still be considered to be light work. And it generates the 10% which comes in an obvious place where you can add real value. And because I understood the social media, I also understood recruiting and I understood a bit about HR, there was a lot of work opportunities that came out of those things.
Yeah, so let's talk about that for a little bit, Bill, because I guess the question is, you did social media more or less to avoid gardening or what we call honeydew projects over here. And I get that. I think I still do that sometimes today, but you dove into social media and I think then and now you still have an eye for kind of the new thing. You were willing to try things, I guess, some things worked. It true had the Recruiting Gun Conference had, I think, like multiple versions, right? You've tried different partnerships, but it lives on. It keeps evolving. How did you come upon that idea? Once you kind of threw yourself into social media, how did you come upon the idea of the Recruiting Gun Conference? And let's talk about its development a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, literally, it started under a tree in Toronto. So, I remember as social media was coming together for the first time, there was an event being run by Recruiting Blogs. So now working with Recruiting Blogs has kind of gone full circle, which was called Recruit Fest. And there was John Sumser there and Jerry Crispin, Jenny Devaughn, Jerry Albright, Recruited Animals. So lots of us who had never met at that time didn't really know each other. We met for the first time at that event, and it was a really hot and noisy event in a hall because we were all excited about what we thought this social media was going to bring us, but none of us had any hard evidence of anything we could talk about. It was really, this is what we think is going to happen. This is what we think we could do. And we were all really excitable about that. It was too noisy, too loud, and there was presentations. And I just said, right, I'm just going to go and sit underneath a tree and talk. Anyone who wants to come out here and talk to me about recruiting can come and do that. And within about 20 minutes, we had about 80 people sitting underneath a tree just talking about recruiting. And I just thought, you know what, this is something that I want to do. I'd always had this vision that the way in which people were connecting at that time was, first of all, you only connected with people where there was a really clear objective, where you felt it was someone you were going to do business with. The second thing was recruiting was done, connections were done on a very local basis. It wasn't a global thing. So although we had this global platform, people were only connecting with people where they could see an obvious benefit or financial gain. I wanted to change that and just connect with interesting people. And I also didn't care what those people did, whether they were people looking for a job, whether they were vendors working in the space, whether they were recruiters or HR folk or whatever they were. I just wanted to connect people, introduce people, have conversations. And I think the first time we really saw the power of that was I did a HR Carnival video series at the time when kind of video technology was new. And a lot of people coming onto the scene had never been seen by other people. They were just at the end of the Twitter rank. And we ended up doing something like 110 videos of people like Laurie Ruterman and Trisha McFarlane and yourself and Recruiting Animal. And that kind of went on and really showed me that actually what we needed to do, now we have this new media, was find a place where people could connect and be their own community and not try and organise it and not try and over-manufacture people. And that's really what True's become. It was only ever going to be one event, which was about 300 and something events ago. We've now been in 5 continents. I was in India earlier this year. We've been in the Far East, in China, places like that. And we really wanted it to become a community where people connected without really looking on it as a financial thing.
So, and out of all that, oddly enough, I've been to, I think, one True event, which was in Madison, which is actually where I met Brian Wempen, you know, which kind of connects us back to the show.
And I couldn't go.
Right. And you were actually there. You were actually there via video.
Skype.
I don't know if it was Skype or something, but I remember we were in this meeting facility, and you ran a session through Skype because of the whatever it is, Aya the
volcano.
I can't pronounce the Icelandic name of the volcano.
Yeah.
So that's the only True that I've ever been to, but that's where I met Brian. But I knew you, at least from, as you said, through the connections of Twitter and other things before.
Yeah,
we
did a blog series fairly early on. And the reaction we got to that blog series was quite interesting because it was indicative of that time in that you ran a series called Over There on human race horses.
Human race horses.
I managed to get a bunch of bloggers from Australia, New Zealand, and the UK and other places other than the US. And we kind of gave forum to a lot of new voices through that, but it indicated the time, because you had some people who really embraced it and said, yeah, this is great. You had other people kind of saying, well, why should I get involved, because I'm not going to have any clients in North America, there's no financial benefit to me to doing that,
right?
And I think it was that time, it was that piece that I hold of and thought, you know what, and bearing in mind, I was coming at it, so I was networking without really having a company or product. I was figuring out what I was going to do. And so I was just connecting with people for the conversation and for the good connection, rather than thinking there's a deal here, or this is a target client, or this is a target candidate. And I learned a lot from that time about actually... you just connect with people, you just do the right things, you help people where you can, you connect people where you can, and sometimes where you're going to do business with them becomes obvious. Most of the people you're not going to do business with, but that shouldn't be your driver.
Okay. So do you mind, because I'm always curious, when you do a True event, like say in Asia, can you give us a little bit of a preview behind where the sponsorships come from and how you develop that type of forum, or is it just very organic?
I know you don't have a lot of planning
in your process.
Yeah, it's very organic. So you've got to have enough planning that people are comfortable, and that comes into certain things. That comes into getting the venue and making sure you've got a body of people who are enthusiastic and driven around bringing people, about getting the right people. So, and who those people are, which will pretty much dictate what that event is. So the events I've just run in India were actually funded by a company called NASPERS I'm doing some work with. They wanted to research the recruitment market in India. The best way was to run an event in Bangladesh, Bangalore, not Bangladesh, and run an event in Delhi, and invite the right people in and have the right conversations. What you get wherever you go is the 80-20 rule really applies. So 80% of what we talk about around the world is pretty much the same. It revolves around things like branding. There's always a bit of legal compliance in it. There's always some new technology. There's always how do we source. This is the talent short market. This is the busy market. And these are the things that we're talking about and real examples of what people are doing. The 20% is local. And you get the 20%, even if you're going somewhere in the States, from the way an event would be in San Francisco to, say, the way an event would be in New York to the way an event would be in Columbus, Ohio, or Baton Rouge in Louisiana. The 20% is local. These are our issues. And it's always the 20% I'm really interested in. What are the things that make your job interesting and difficult? Now, the other thing that we do, because this was something I was really passionate about, is most events operate occupational apartheid. And this is a core value of True, really. So when we talk about occupational apartheid, usually the vendors and the practitioners are split up. Like they're different people. They have different values to that conversation.
Right.
We don't want any of that, because I believe everybody has an interest in the topic we're talking about. And everyone has a unique viewpoint based on their experience. So if you're the mobile guy, you should be the best guy to do mobile. The fact that that you might be a consultant with some real expertise in dealing in multiple companies, say union issues, you should be the best guy to talk about unions, because you have the most experience of that. So when you can bring all those people together and not separate them out as these people are vendors, these people are practitioners, these people are techies, these people are bloggers. Well, you just bring everyone together in a room and say, this is the topic, and anyone who's interested, talk about this. That's where the magic happens. Anyone who starts pitching their product gets thrown out of that arena anyway. And I don't have to do that. I don't have to police that. So that was one of the first things for me, is anyone who's interested in the conversation is welcome, because everyone has something to add. And this whole argument about practitioners and vendors and all this kind of thing really makes no sense to me. I think we fragment the market into silos for certain people's personal interest. We shouldn't be doing that. I think the other thing that happens with events is one of the things I learned fairly early on is you're not going to make any money out of events unless you become an event company. And the things you have to do to become an event company are not conducive to conversation and are not conducive to being leading edge. And that's no disrespect to event companies who do a great job. But the reality is you've got to do certain things. You've got to have booths and vendors, you've got to have, you separate out your vendors and practitioners, you have one person speaking at the front who usually is sharing an old case. For a case study to become a presentation at a conference, it is normally between 18 months and 2 years old. And that's a pretty nice history lesson. But it's not current. It's not in the conversation. The other thing I've learned is everywhere I went, the smartest person in the room is usually somebody none of us knows. So I've met people like Stacey Donovan Zappa. I've met people like Brian Cheney. I've met Lars Schmidt. I've met folks like Johnny Campbell, but Johnny Campbell, even before he had a trading company when he was a recruiter, they've come into the room and just had something different or extra about them. And we get them in every event, and eventually they become the conference darlings and the people who go and do all the presentations and stuff like that. But because if you buy a ticket, you can run a track. If you've got a topic you want to talk about, you can talk about it. Because we encourage people to just leave sessions if they don't like what they're getting. So the participants will vote with their feet if you're not very good. So we've unearthed most of the people who have ultimately come through onto the circuit because we've given them that platform.
Go ahead.
The other point as a core principle is the cost of admission should never bar people from being able to participate. Because ultimately, you can get your money. We now do donations, so we ask people to pay what they think it's worth to them. And you know, some of the people who come from tech companies will pay more. I don't ever want students or somebody working who can't get that sign-off or release to not be able to come to the event and learn because they don't have the budget for it or they can't afford to pay the $1,000 or the $2,000 to get a ticket. So I don't ever want that to happen. And this is how you become a community. This is where you take care of each other, and it's for the good of all of us.
Do you have any notion of how many people have actually attended True events? Do you track that at all? Or
yeah, I mean we track it through ticket attendance. So you're probably talking about over the years, it's going to be somewhere like 4,000-4,500 people. We get anywhere between 30 people at an event to 350 in Paris. So it's different everywhere according to the event.
Yeah.
London that we'll have will be about 120, 130. We cap it at that.
That's your kind of like your sweet spot size for your event?
Yeah, I think, well, they're always different, Mike. So if you have a small group of people, you can have a much more intimate conversation and you might network a bit more with those individual people. If you have a larger event, you'll have more conversations. So there's, when we talk about sweet spot, if we have a space, we make it work. And the other thing, the way in which we've driven the growth of this now is saying, if somebody wants to run a True event anywhere, you don't need to sign a license. You don't need to give us any money. You don't need to do anything in a commercial sense other than respect the way that we do things and we'll promote you and we'll support you. We're beginning to get some foundation sponsors who want to give an overarching sponsorship around the websites and stuff like that. But really, if you want to run a local event, it's your event, it's your community. And you know, my dream is to see, I get something like 300 requests a year to have a True event. I want people running their own events everywhere, even if they're running it in a lunchtime or as an evening meetup or a whole day event or on a weekend, whatever works for them. If we can connect people to talk openly and honestly about their issues, then we can begin to make recruiting better. And that's really got to be our driving force in whatever we do, whether you're a tech company, whether you're a candidate looking for a job, whether you're a student, whether you work in HR, you're a hiring manager. We should all be working on saying, how do we make this better? How do we all work together better? And how do we collaborate? And we have the answers as long as people network and talk and are honest. I think you go away from a True event with more questions than answers. The key is you connect with the people who can give you those answers.
Yeah. I find it interesting that, you know, the idea of True was, you know, because recruiting blogs today is a different recruiting blogs than it was back then. Different ownership, whole different thing. As True has kind of, you know, that seems common.
Yeah. It became important to me in terms of the point of partnering and going into kind of the Recruit Daily stuff was, firstly, I was doing a lot of work with the guys anyway, with Matt Charney and Noel and Ryan. I've blogged with a lot of times. it's a huge community. So there's 750,000 people on recruiting daily. That's without the folks in India and places like that. It's got the widest global footprint, but the closest to community. So I needed to work with people who understood, you're not going to make any money out of this. This isn't what this is about. It's not a commercial venture. You will make money. And this is something I'd say to anyone who's thinking about networking today. How do I build a network? How do I go on? People ask me all the time, how do you build this kind of network? How do you get to be successful? You have to make a real fundamental decision in the early days. Am I going to make money from my network or because of my network? And the truth of what we're trying to bring is to make money because of our network. Because if we talk to 2,500 people a year about recruiting, about what's going on, about what the trends are, every one of those conversations gives you a little bit of knowledge. You pick up the gems. You make the connections who can help you. You will work. You will meet people who will want to work with you because they like what you're talking about. But the driving force there is always, if we make the community, if we make the collaboration better, and I sometimes sound a bit like a tree hugger on this topic. You know, if we do the right things and we operate in the right way, and it's taken me a while to get there. I've had some bad partnerships where it became too much about trying to make money. I've come to the firm conclusion that really the events are not about making money. The events are about making connections and making recruiting better. And if we're driven that way, we will make money along the way from the people that we meet or the knowledge that we acquire. The trade-off is I'll help on a great event, wherever that might be. I'll join that conversation. I will leave wiser and better able to provide value to the people who actually pay me.
Right. Let me do a quick reset, Bill, just in case someone's joined in. This is Mike Vandervoort, and we're talking today to Bill Boorman. Bill is kind of legendary, creator of True and some other things. But our conversation today is about some life lessons that Bill has learned along the way as he made a radical transition from owning a training company and being sort of a corporate guy into an innovator in the social media and recruiting space. And I was trying to play some background music, but I couldn't hear it. So anyway, so Bill, if you had to look back to when you sort of, you know, set yourself off on this trail that, sounds as if you did it without, there was no master plan. You were just doing stuff. And you,
No, there never has been. There's never been a master plan to say. And I actually think that's beneficial. I think we spend too long on strategy and not enough on trying. We try and follow best practice and not test practice.
I was going to ask...
And we worry too much about looking stupid and doing things wrong. That's not a fear of mine.
Yeah. I have that fear every now and then. Would you have any advice for your, you know, for the Bill Boorman of, trying to avoid putting up shelves? Would you have any advice today, looking back, for that guy who started on that path?
Yeah. I think the first thing is to start off with that point. We're going to build a network. Let's not have an objective about that. Let's not go looking for ROI. Let's go looking for conversations and joining those conversations and understand the things that you can add value. I just did a session recently that I was asked to deliver, which is how do you be a thought leader? And my answer to that was point number one, have a thought. Because I see too many people, and I met some guys recently that were really interesting, who really made me think about this. So I met some guys at Comic-Con in London, where I took my children, and they had some of the vloggers now who have who get maybe 7 million, 18 million, up to 18 million views of their videos every day and run a great business and make a lot of money from it. And I was just chatting with them afterwards in the bar and said, you know, the Yogcast guys and so on, and said, which anyone who has kids will know who they are, and said, how did you, you know, what do you think about the vloggers coming through? And he said, well, the vloggers who are coming through are really struggling because they're trying to be vloggers. When we became vloggers and they make videos of people playing games, we did that because that's what we did among our friends. And that's what felt right. And this is what we wanted to do. We wanted to share stuff and just do stuff. So, and I think I, and that really rang true with me. And they said, and people who are trying to do this as a job or an occupation, people who are trying to be a thought leader, people who are trying to be regarded as a guru or be an expert, they fall down as wooden pretty quickly. They might, and we've seen a lot of these people come and go over the years, Mike, as you know, who have short bursts of popularity. The real people, I think, who've had some kind of longevity in this space, continuously looking at what you're doing, doing what's the right thing, and you've got to immerse yourself in. You've got to immerse yourself in the channels and in the conversation with people, because that's how you. That's really how you, how it becomes obvious the ways in which you make money. It means people come to you. You don't go to people. You just make it really clear what you can do and where you can add value. You do that through your profiles, and just create and live your life as content in everything that you're doing. And everything's content. And don't try and build up this image of what you are that isn't really what you are.
Yeah, you know, it's tough, right? Like, I know I am not as immersed today in, I mean, the technology doesn't, there's fragmented technology, but like I tried Snapchat and lost interest in it pretty fast. You know, I had Periscope on my phone and lost interest in it pretty
for 7 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and but it doesn't mean that there isn't value in Periscope just because I lost interest in it. But it's the...
Yeah, I'd always say to people, if you're thinking about Periscope, don't go looking for the value in Periscope. Find out how it works. So for me,
right.
In the beginning, it was all about Twitter. I hardly use Twitter at all now. For lots of reasons. So it was all about Twitter. Now it's all about Facebook. And I'm doing some, and commercially I'm doing stuff in other places like Slack channels for tech recruiting, all that kind of thing. But it was about Facebook. So, but the first thing you've got to do is you've got to be immersed in social in it yourself, because you have to understand the way the channels work. And you have to understand that the way the channels work quite often change on a day-to-day basis. So while it might be Facebook today, it might be somewhere else. There was a time when everybody had to have a blog. Now I don't think you need a blog at all. You just need to create content. So it's always been different. And the key is being involved enough to react to these things when they happen, to understand what's interesting. What's really happening is the internet is shrinking. Right, the internet is shrinking. It's not getting wider. So the way in which content is delivered, the way in which we see things, is about getting. If we talk about what influence is getting in the line of visibility of the right people. Really, that's how I would define it. And you're only visible to people who interact with you and you interact with. And the internet will only deliver content, and that doesn't matter whether it's through Google or on Facebook through your feed, or on Twitter, LinkedIn, anywhere else. The channels work harder and harder on delivering what they think is relevant content to you. So that's really geared by your footprint and who you interact with. So you've got to look at that and say, and increasingly this has been influenced by things which are involuntary, including things like recorded data on your phones and that kind of thing. We could do a whole different show on the data for good, data for evil stuff that I talk about. I think we're at a real precipice on that in terms of how we're using data in the HR space. But really, our line of vision is getting narrower. It's not getting wider, although we have all these channels connected with everyone. So I think that's changing the way that we work. And you've got to be in that to understand that.
And you know, I agree with that. I guess where I was going to verge away from that a little bit is you engage in other types of events. You go to Comic-Con. It has nothing to do with recruiting. Your son is a gamer.
It has everything to do with recruiting. It has everything to do with recruiting. Right? What the games do, they go and recruit players. They just actually do it better than recruiters.
So you outline that for us. You try to learn from your observation of other situations. How do you define that?
It's just the way I'm wired. It's not a deliberate conscious thing. So everything is about people, right? So if you go to something like Comic-Con and you go and talk to some people, so you're talking to people who make viral content way beyond anything we've ever experienced in the HR space. You know, great shows like HR Happy Hour, all the rest of it. Maybe 300 people listen to that. You go and talk to someone who makes a video of them playing a game with somebody else, and you ask, why did this happen? How did this happen? How did they end up getting 18 million views on a video? What was the dynamics behind that? And what you discover is all of these guys who and girls who are like that, they didn't start out to do that. They just videoed two buddies playing a game, and other people were interested in the game. And they built up following, and they got people. If you run a game, you know, if you work for... You think about referrals. The ultimate referral system is the games, the people who send you stuff, your connections who send you stuff every day saying, come and join my mafia gang, or come and join my Jules gang, or come and have a look at this game, or come and have a look at this stuff, you know. So it all follows the same online activity as we're trying to achieve, and except they're doing it better than we are, because we're tied usually in recruiting in HR with legacy systems, processes and methodology, which is quite risk averse. So we tend to follow methodology and technique which was developed 5 years ago. You know, it's kind of like the history of the internet when you go to an HR conference.
Right.
So you go to something like Comic-Con, you go to a games conference, you go to something which is not trying to be a trade show, and you just look at it and say, how have these people become successful? I mean, the best books that I read, I think my favorite book is Hooked. I can't remember who wrote it, but you can check it out. And it's how did Facebook build addictive technology that has become embedded in our life that we don't even think about it anymore?
Right.
We just check into places. We just like things. We automatically comment when we do so. I'll finish the show and I'll put a comment on Facebook. That's instinctive. That's not marketing. But
right.
It's fine.
People
will like it and show it to other people. And I think that part of... It's just how you are in life, that when you go and you look at things and think, how did all these people end up in this place? What happened?
I was at a Disrupt HR event in Cleveland, Ohio, this past week. I presented with Chris Dunn, Frank Zupan, and Tammy Coulson were there. And, you know, it was 5 minutes, right? Disrupt HR. Very, very different, although it was sponsored by Cleveland Sherm. It was 5 minute sort of like Ignite presentations. Had a blast. But what was more interesting to me actually was I stayed in a bed and breakfast because the Republican National Convention, or not the Republican, the debate that happened last week also took place the same night as Disrupt HR. So I was bumped out of my hotel space by a high profile individual, is what I was told. And I wound up staying in a bed and breakfast. And in talking to, I think her name was the bed and breakfast owner, you know, I'd ask her, like, how do I get to the train station? How do I get to? And everything that came out of her mouth was, ooh, just grab an Uber.
Grab an Uber. Just go and do this stuff.
Grab an Uber. Yeah, I'd just Uber over there. You know, Uber's a verb now, right? And in the bed and breakfast industry, at least in Cleveland, it's easier to, you know, you don't even think about a taxi. You just get an Uber.
And where do you get those things? Priceline and Bookings.com, where do you check them out? And the amazing thing about all this tech is when we talk about it, very often we're talking about something which is less than 5 years old.
Right.
Which has changed the way we lead our lives.
It's incredible. So we're down, you know, getting down these shows are set now to go to 45 minutes, and we're still going to try to stick to 30, but it's always such a joy to talk to you that we're into the, you know, the 41st minute here, Bill. You mentioned True Dublin, a couple other things. What have you got going on? And then I'd like, if you could for a minute, you are on a couple of boards, and you're an advisor to a lot of companies, and I think that's kind of a new development, and I just wondered if you could touch on those two things, what you've got coming up next.
I'm a lead advisor, which is different to being an advisor. So I put together advisory boards for startups, and I work with them on things like what their product should look like, what the market feedback, what problems should we actually be trying to solve with this. So probably the longest one I've been with is Rollpoint. I'm with Take the Interview, Magi, which is a data matching technology, iGrads, which is a graduate platform, Clinch, which is a new recruiting marketing platform, which is the latest one that I'm working with, JobFig, which is an assessment and testing. So I really work with the startups on product to try and bring some reality to it. I also work with VCs on where they should invest and what they should be doing and what's interesting technology. And whether you're a lead advisor, it can be anything, because mostly you're dealing with young folks, and it can be anything from sometimes the wisdom of life in helping people out. You know, I've done everything from helping someone talk about their wedding, and you know, down to life decisions, down to investors, to who should we sell our company to at this point, because we've got a valuation in of 70 million or whatever it is. And quite often from an introduction that I've been able to affect. So I love that work, because technology plays such a big part that we're only going to be able to make recruiting better for all the stakeholders, not just the people who write checks, but for the candidates. I do the other thing I do is I'm privileged to be on the County Council for UK and Europe, and also a little involved in North America with Jerry Crispin. So how do we actually make things better? And part of making things better is through technology, part methodology, part technology. So that's why I love working with startups, and it's somewhere where in lots of different ways I can add real value. So the money that they pay me is money earned, rather than just money that they pay me. It's not about being a name above the door. So that's what I do with with the startups. I also have some equity in about 25 different technology companies, which I've been gifted at different times for advisory and other stuff. So that's kind of where and then I'm working on a project with Naspers, where we've got which is the sixth biggest internet company in the world that no one's heard of, where we've got to look at how we hire for 100 companies in 125 countries.
Wow.
You know, so and that'll mean doing some work in Africa. We've just done India and other places. So those kind of things really interest me. And it's the 90% of what you do in terms of connecting in your network and providing value and being with the right people that provides that 10% that gives you revenue. And that's where the true stuff fits in for me. And taking it on through Recruit Daily, we've had bad experiences with partnerships where we've tried to monetize and turn people over a little bit. This is the bit where it's really about how do we, you know, this is the bit where we can reach enough people to actually try and make things better. And that's got to be the driver. That's got to be the thing. How do we make things better? And we'll earn some money along the way. We may not be rich, but we'll earn some money along the way.
Great. So, and you mentioned True Dublin. What else?
True London is on the 4th of September, which is also my 50th birthday. So
congratulations.
It's True London 50. So we're going to have the event. Steve Bose is coming over, and Trish McFarland, you know, some friends of ours. Stacey Donovan Zappa. There's going to be a whole bunch of people in London. But the thing about True London is, normally the lowest number of countries we have people attending is 24. We've got Trevor Vass is coming over from Australia. Stan Rolfe is bringing over Oculus Rift, where he works, which is using with a mining company. He's bringing over from Australia to show that. So there's a whole, and what I'm most excited about is I've managed to get Coda Dojo to come in to set up a one-day coding school for local school kids under 16.
Congratulations.
Which they're going to be running as a pop-up thing in the middle of the event.
We're out of time. Thanks for being on the show.
We can talk forever, Mike. It's always a pleasure.
Happy birthday early, and good luck with True London, and I'll catch up with you soon. Thanks.
Let's talk soon. Thanks, Mike.